Greetings, I think I'll start. We just had an interesting discussion in this room about socialism, and part of my head is bubbling in that direction. Hopefully I'll be able to refocus with all of you and talk about everyone's favorite topic. Taxes. And this week I've been talking about citizenship and sort of some of the tensions between Christianity and being called to be a Christian and that being part of this world and part in particular for most of us citizens of the United States, though we have some Maple Leaf friends who remove themselves actually from the American sphere by sitting upstairs. But I want to start just by sort of defining what I'm hoping we can think about today. And obviously I'm being slightly provocative. I think talking about taxes is sort of provocative in the first place. And I think it was last year, Alan Story was here. I know, everyone loves Alan. My wife has a huge crush on him. She has it. Well, she acts it, but she's also brilliant and charismatic and tortured all at the same time. But I think in one of his sessions, he ends up talking about the fact that, and I think he said Americans, but he might have said other nations too, but he said Americans are willing to talk about pretty much anything except how much money they make. And we don't like to talk about finances because in some ways how much money we make defines sort of our social status, whether we like it or not. And it allows us to purchase certain clothes, it gives us a sense of place in the world, our house, all those kinds of things. And I think taxes are related to that. I mean, it's certainly true in this country right now, the degree of rhetoric about taxes, I think, is extraordinary. Thank you. So what I like to do is just think about taxes as a tithe. And again, I'm being a little coy with that. And I have some assumptions underneath what I'm doing, too, that I just hope we can frame our discussion. Otherwise, we might go into never-never. And I'm assuming that there is a necessary and rather wide role for government, that we live in a rather complex society. And we have roads, we have national parks, we have medical care, we have health care, we have educational issues that requires us to have some political system that deals with social cooperation in those ways. So I'm sort of assuming that. And I'm also asking this question as a Christian, I'm Lutheran, that says that ultimately there is a connection between the political sphere and God's actions. And I don't know if Michael covered this in Thomas, but in Catholic thought there's a much clearer connection than there is in most Protestant thought, which is some of the things we explored yesterday. But ultimately I'm sort of narrowly defining that. I'm not trying to really flush it out, but I'm just going to ask that we sort of assume that there is a connection between our hands and God's hands. To use some of the Lutheran language. And then it also assumes that we can be Christians and citizens at the same time. And that's not entirely the case for all forms of Christianity. Several of us talked yesterday after my session, and I ended up bringing up St. Anthony. St. Anthony was an Egyptian desert monk who believed that the only way to really commune with God was to live in a cave and deny all his physical needs. And clearly that's a sort of radical form of Christianity, much more radical, I think, than any of us would adhere to Christianity. So it does assume that we live in this world, the creation's good, our social life is good, and as a consequence, we can be Christians and citizens. Maybe there's a tension there, and in a lot of ways, what I'm doing, or have been doing this week, is to ask us to think about that tension in a way that really, hopefully, asks us to be critical in both kind of both directions. It's also true that it's a challenge, and this partially comes out of some of the conversations we've had this week. Is, you know, how do we, or can we, should we, ought we, must we compromise Christian values and I'm going to use that loosely too a little bit. I'll define it a little bit further as we go along, because I know that's a loaded word too, Christian value in particular, but for a greater good. And then also, we also are inherited of a tradition, both biblical but also theological, that it's, and I think this is particularly true within the Protestant tradition, that we're not entirely clear about what a government should be, what it should do, what legitimizes it, what authorizes it. But it is true that there are episodes in the Bible that deal with taxation. For instance, in Exodus 30, God orders Moses to collect a tax for the tent-like sanctuary or tabernacle that the Israelites used for worship. It's a temple tax. But it implies an element of giving to something broader than just God in this case. It's the establishment of a tabernacle, which is both a building and also a sacred site. You also see, too, in 2 Chronicles 24, the Israelites gladly paid taxes to rebuild the Jerusalem temple, though King Joash is later punished by God for abandoning the project. Then in Matthew 17, Jesus asked Peter to pay a temple tax for the two of them using an unusual method. Peter's catch a fish with a coin. And then in Luke 3, when tax collectors ask him how to live, Jesus tells them only this: don't collect any more than you are required to. I mean, obviously there's some tensions here, in particular with the Hebrew Bible examples. The tax goes to God's house. So that's a holy site. So holy site, okay, we give our money to church. But can this be some type of example for us to think about other ways our institutions can do God's work? And then clearly here, Jesus, he doesn't say don't pay your taxes. You pay your taxes, you're committing an idolatrous act. He doesn't say anything clearly negative about it. And I think part of these, it requires us to interpret. It requires us to ask questions. It requires us to think about what our Christian values are when it comes to the role of the government, when it comes to taxes. And then we also have this rather infamous statement. This is from the Synoptics. Give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's. And this tax has been used in a number of different ways, and briefly, it was used by whites during the civil rights era to criticize civil disobedience. Along with Romans 13, there's the undergirding that ultimately there's a split. It's supposed to be conservative dualism, not conservation. A conservative dualism. There's a split then between what's God's and what's, let's say, creation's. What's the political? There's this dualism, and they don't intermix. And you as a Christian then have to ensure that you don't mix. That kind of idea, I think, is within our tradition as Christians. And I think it raises a lot of challenges for us. I think it raises a lot of tensions for us that asks us again to interpret it. It's also true that the majority of German Christians read this, and it was used by the German church to support, or let's say, tacitly approve Nazi ideology. It's not very radical, which is why it should say conservative dualism. And it's also true, I think, that I say historical Jesus, not a nation builder. I mean, we could go further, too, that the historical Jesus was also not an institution builder. He wasn't the one who laid out the rules of... He did not have an ecclesiology, or at least the type of ecclesiology most of us are used to today. So this gives us some, at least hopefully, foundation to engage thinking about taxes and whatnot.
Peter, there's one more interpretation of that passage.
I'm sure there's one more than one more. But.
Yeah, but what I mean is in that some theologians of liberation, for example, interpret that passage as indeed not paying taxes to an oppressive, dominating regime. In other words, you give to Caesar what is what really is Caesar's, nothing, and what is God's, everything. So in other words, you know, you give Caesar the old Bronx cheer, and everything else goes to God. And at least in the Luke version of that, it's when Jesus is arrested and Pilate asks, what are the charges? The charge brought against him is, he said we shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar. So at least in that one instance, it's taken basically as for unjust, oppressive regimes, you should be resisted, sure, not paying taxes.
That's a great segue. But rather than starting with the more conservative perspective, I think I'll start then with Christian tax resistance, in which a tax like the rendering of Caesar is actually used to justify not paying taxes. And there is this group, it's called the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. It's online if anyone's curious. I can even actually, if anyone wants, I can just pass this around. But it is a sort of loose conglomeration that tries to use Christian teaching as a means to justify not paying taxes, primarily because of the role of violence within the government. And so what they do is they offer sort of a problem. And the problem is that about 50% of U.S. tax dollars for the U.S. military budget at some form. This is the figure they use. Obviously, that goes up and down. Obviously, that's not always accurate. But there still is, it still is the case that there's a significant amount of money that goes to supporting violence and defense, as we like to call it. You know, defense of the homeland. And the question they really ask, okay, so military, is how does the idea of violence in the military relate to our calling as Christians? And their interpretation is that any type of war, they're very sort of pacifist in this instance, is the violation of Christ's commandments. And to do so, in fact, to participate in any type of violence, to be a soldier, for instance, is then to exist outside of God's kingdom. And what they do is that they say that ultimately, what is Christian love? And you see this in a lot of ethical thinking, that ultimately the truest form of Christian love is when you love your neighbor. But the neighbor is your enemy. And if that's the standard, that's the true norm for Christian love, then it flies in the face of defense, active military adventures, regime change. They also use, surprisingly to me at least, they use Roman 13, that ends with love never does anything wrong to the neighbor. And we talked about Romans 13 a little bit yesterday, not very well. I think that was my fault. But Romans 13 is one must give obedience to the ruling authorities because they're instituted by God. And the way they read Romans 13 is that ultimately it's checked. Obedience to the powers that be is checked by the fact that you are called to love first. So any obedience has to adhere to one's Christian calling of love. They also look at Acts, and I think Acts, you know, Acts is, I know a lot of New Testament scholars that don't like Acts, because they read it as a Christian triumphalist text. And it's the story of the greatness of the church as it forms for the first time over amongst special Jewish practices. But the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, which I wish, I almost wish they'd come up with a better name, but so I could say it more easily. But they look at Acts, which if we also read Acts, there's a lot in there that I think is really interesting. That we are called to obey God rather than the authorities of the world. All of this, in their view, leads to the acts of civil disobedience. That ultimately any of our national laws are judged under God's law of love. And they see Jesus as a lawbreaker, they see the disciples as a lawbreaker, which I think Michael eloquently brought up too. And so they refuse then to pay board taxes, as they call them. They think it's an essential act of Christian love. They support paying taxes if it goes to things like roads and education and healthcare and things like that. And they call it a tithe. In their view, then you can sort of... they take their tax bill, most of them, and divide it by 50% or whatever percentage goes to the U.S. defense budget as a means to decide how much they're actually going to pay in terms of their taxes. Because they see it in this way. Any thoughts or concerns? Or how many people are familiar with this group anyway, or a similar group?
What has been the government's response to the refusal to pay?
It's been various at different times. I mean, it is illegal.
What proof?
But it has depended on who's in power in terms of prosecution. But, you know, it is also true that in their view, such prosecution, which is ultimately a form of persecution, is also the act of Christian servanthood.
How do they distinguish between the money that goes to war versus the money that goes to Medicare?
What they do is, you know, the U.S. government does publish its budget, which, you know, I've looked at a number of times and I can't understand it. But it is the case that what they do, and it's not, as far as I know, it's not super sophisticated, and any of you might know a little more than I do, but they just sort of figure out how much actually goes to the U.S. military. And as a consequence, that percentage is taken out of their own tax bill.
Has anybody like questioned them? Because it you know, like saying, hey, you know, you are members of society as well. What you are saying is like, it's as if you are playing a game and then you, at a point you don't like the points that have been scored against you, and then you withdraw and say like, forget it, I'm not playing the game.
Sure. Your question is, is that a critique of them?
Yeah, no, like whether there have been something like that, like other people who question wars, other pacifists, right? Have they said like, no, that's not the way to go? I mean, we have to collectively, in a joint effort, change the policies of the state, of our state. We are co-responsible of that, and we should change our foreign policy so that we don't go off with this military adventure, something like that, no?
I don't know of any succinct. I mean, I'll be honest here. This is not a big group. Right? You know, I think most Americans pay their taxes. I suspect most Americans. Supposedly, most Americans cheat on their taxes too. It's something like 60% of Americans cheat on their taxes. Which might go back to some of the issues you were raising. I do think it's true that not only do most people pay their taxes, that underneath this is an assumption about a proper and just use of government resources. That it's not so much that the government as a whole is corrupt, that democracy as a whole is corrupt, but it's how it uses the gifts of its community and its the resources and talents. And the problem is if it goes to violence and war, then that's a violation of God's norm for Christians. But the government itself does a lot of vital and important things.
Okay. And because just following up on that argument, like the people on the conservative side, you know, Tea Party, they can say, oh, you know, we don't want to pay taxes because the taxes are used to, you know, for the social safety net. Why should we, you know?
I'm sure we'll talk about the Tea Party. I think the Tea Party is hard to talk about. It's because it's such a loosely allied group that You know, we make lots of generalizations that tend to be reductionistic when we talk about them. But it's certainly true that there are, well, actually, let's, can we save that question for when I talk about Gary North and Christian economics? Because when I read it, I was like, ew. But there's a hand.
I was just going to say that I imagine this group wouldn't put themselves in a position where they were outside the security provided by the structure we live in. If they were to do that, then maybe I'd say, okay, maybe they've got something. But they're enjoying the security that we all enjoy. Yet they don't have support.
Well, but arguably, by not paying it, are they enjoying the security? Because it puts them at risk of being arrested.
Well, they're breaking the law, for sure. But they're not in any more danger from terrorism, for example, than I am.
Sure. Okay.
There are other groups that don't pay their taxes for other reasons. Like Willie Nelson, for instance.
Willie Nelson?
Yeah. Feds follow him around because he has so much taxes. A bunch of right-wing groups don't pay their taxes for this and that reason.
Any other thoughts about this? Should we move on? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of undemocratic in a sense that to say that, you know, my thoughts are superior to the collective wisdom. I think, you know, living in a society, we have to accept that maybe there are some things the government does that we don't agree with.
Sure.
But you can't nitpick each decision, because otherwise everybody is going to have something they don't like that the government does, and to give each person the authority to overrule kind of leads to anarchy.
Or, to put it partially the way I was framing it earlier, that it's not necessarily a reflection of how we function democratically, which entails compromise. But it is a suggestion that to be a Christian is not...
You better plug in.
To be a Christian, that to be a Christian is to be uncompromising, or some degree of uncompromising of one's Christian call. Oops. Other thoughts or concerns, or shall we certainly move on? Okay. Has anyone heard of Gary North? I asked some folks earlier. He has a website still. He's a Presbyterian minister. He felt that modern Presbyterianism, though, moved too far away from the teachings of Calvin. And in the early 70s, he decided to elaborate a theology of Christian economics. And so he wrote a 400-page book on Christian economics. I found it online. You can download it. Not sure I should tell people that, but PDF. And he is a follower of a guy named Ludwig von Mises, an Austrian classical liberal economist. And what von Mises said is that ultimately human beings act purposely to achieve desired goal. Maybe purposely can be our word of the day. You know, facticity and religiosity, but you know, ultimately you're saying that each of us, and you'll notice that there's some key words in here. Julio, is this a word that you were talking about earlier?
Which one?
Individual. The socialism section, obviously, was in social cooperation. He's not saying that we as social beings act purposely. He's saying that we each individually act that way. And each individual also has desired goals. Each of us has desires that we enact, and we use our sense of logic and reason in order to act on those goals to achieve them. He then believes that the only viable economic policy is unrestricted laissez-faire capitalism. The free markets and the unhampered right of private property. So what's the role of government? Yep, limited government. It's strictly limited to the defense of person and property within its territorial area. So that's Ludwig. And from this economics position, what Gary North does is he takes the teaching here of Ludwig and Mises and unites it with what his view is of the Christian tradition. And what he says is this. Oh, that shouldn't be there. But he says that as we read in Genesis, God has cursed the earth. And as a consequence, the earth no longer gives up her fruits automatically. So man must sweat to eat. I didn't obviously change the gender. So if man must sweat to eat, ultimately, and this follows this statement about Genesis, that he quotes Paul. If any would not work, neither should he eat. And he this is a quote from him too, and it's from 2 Thessalonians. And the general scholarly consensus is that 2 Thessalonians was not written by Paul, just historically. Just also tells you something about how he's using the Bible here. And ultimately then, what's sin? It's alienation. He uses the same word that Julio used earlier to talk about Marx. And alienation is we are alienated from the fruits of the earth, from the goodness of creation, which then requires us to work in order to live. Because of sin, economic scarcity is a fundamental reality of our existence. And he views socialism as making oneself into God. Because ultimately, each of us individually is responsible for eating and thus working. Each individual then is its own sovereign and responsible being.
So is he saying socialism is a sin?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because ultimately all of us are in this battle for goods. I mean, it's a very Hobbesian perspective. You know? It's a very, very sort of, you know, when I read it, I was like, where is the grace? Is what I initially read. I mean, it's a very low view, too, obviously, human love for that, you know, our desire for things. He then has a section on taxes in this book, Christian Economics. And he says that ultimately, taxing involves the power to destroy. Taxation involves coercion, and the right of coercion necessarily involves the power to destroy. Why? If each of you is entirely responsible for your own food, I would say, or eat, then if someone takes what you've earned legitimately because God has cursed the earth, then guess what? They're violating God's, well, sin is alienation. Economic scarcity. They're violating the reality that each of you is a single individual, completely responsible for success or failure. So ultimately, taxes is coercive destructiveness. The right to lay coercive taxes upon any individual or institution is an assertion of sovereignty. And if each person is a sovereign, solely responsible for their own livelihood, then taxes are immoral, coercive. Yeah.
If that's the case, in the previous slide, he said that there is a role for the nation, and that's for security. So how does he propose that the nation accomplish that if all taxes are coercive?
I don't know. This is actually Ludwig von Mises. I hope that was clear. That this claim is Ludwig's.
Does he subscribe
to that? I don't actually know if he does, because he doesn't, you know, it's a really robust critique of any form of governmental interference on the rights of the individual.
So he proposes there should not be any form of government at all.
I think ultimately that's sort of the implications of his vision, but because he's not necessarily worried about the political sphere, he's much more worried about setting up a defense of free market economies than he is about government interference. Or the sort of legitimization of the political economies. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how influential this book has been? Has it been widely read?
You know, I looked it up, and a lot of the sort of critiques of it said that it's been heavily influential in evangelical circles. But there's been, you know, there wasn't any clear, I read this, and because of this.
Right.
And you know, one of the things when I was researching this, I kept looking for sort of, and maybe this was my mistake to ask this kind of question, but maybe I shouldn't have said that. I kept looking for sustained theological critiques of taxation and property rights and things like that. And I couldn't find it. You know, on Joel Osteen's site, or you know, even Rick Warren's site, for instance, those kinds of Rush Limbaugh. I kept looking on Rush Limbaugh too, just to, Michelle Bachmann, you know, just, and there wasn't a lot. And eventually, putting some dots together, someone mentioned Gary North as being influential. And I just Googled Gary North because I was not familiar with him.
Yeah.
And it led me to this text and some of the wider non-critical perspective.
Yeah, so, but Ludwig von Mises is the main guy from the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. And it's the Tea Party, this is the prophet.
Oh, wow.
There's a Ludwig von Mises, there's like an institute of Ludwig von Mises studies. That they have fellows, I think it's in Southern California, it's attached to some college that I can't remember the name of for right now. That they are promoting this vision of radical capitalism. And he's been quoted more so, like apparently he's been quoted by the mainstream media, and because in the last 5 or 6 years, because of the role that he is playing within the Tea Party, as well as sort of more conservative Christian movements that are aligned with the Tea Party. So, yeah.
I'm missing this step, I guess. This makes sense, perhaps, from a sort of an economic standpoint, but the connection between humans acting rationally as individuals, purposively, that seems terribly anti-Calvin to me. Right, this sort of idea of total depravity. Did you sense where or how a figure like Gary North makes a connection there? I've always seen those as entirely disjointed ideas. I would be interested to see something.
That's a great question.
Try to meld it.
You know, it's not a question I think he's super worried about. I mean, in some ways, one critique of this, and obviously there's many, I mean, you could, you know, which one's more important, the theology or this economic view? Which presupposition trumps the other, such that they fit together in a harmony? And to me, it's this is more important. That's why I put this, didn't bring up Cal, because the first like page of this text is this. So, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a silly question, but how does he square this notion of look out for number one, the universe is created in such a way that everybody looks out for themselves, and if you can't look out for yourself, tough luck. And my attempt to look after you, by the way, is sort of ungodly, or it's me trying to be God. That's not okay. How does he square that with love your neighbors yourself? Like, does he address that conflict? Just kind of conveniently ignores that.
Fundamentally, this idea of God cursing the earth structures the whole system.
Just leaves out this other sort of relatively important part of Christian.
Like the first Christian word of this time.
I mean, I also think that ultimately there are parts of it, as far as I can remember, that it is okay for you, Sean, if you see me passed out over here because, you know, I miss dinner, to go give me some food, and you know, that's your own volition, that's your own sovereign action to express that form of love. But I can't compel you, right? And what are taxes? It's a higher social institution compelling you to take something from you. And by taking something from you, it takes your ability to be responsible and help me out. It's your labor here is what matters. Because your labor enables you to eat. And if I decide not to work, I don't get to eat. That's my fault. That's my responsibility. That's my sovereign issue.
So the reasons that you decide not to work, like you're schizophrenic or something, they don't matter.
Right.
But again, you're saying that the argument is that the government can't make me take care of you, but I may be driven by my own. I might take care of my schizophrenic neighbor because that comes from me voluntarily, and that's acceptable. That's not a violation of God's order. But for Peter the Great to, or Peter the Great, to come and take to take for me and then give to that person over there would be not so much of a deal.
I'll give you into my book.
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, some Christians criticize taxation on the, in the view that, you know, churches and charities should take care of these problems rather in kind of a voluntary fashion rather than the church forcing, compelling people to. The other thing I wanted to mention though here is this caveat about among the able-bodied. So how do we take care of the non-able? Schizophrenic, the paralyzed, the quadriplegic, or, you know, am I responsible for my family? Is society as a whole supposed to take care of them? Because then we need taxes again.
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, he doesn't develop a sort of a deeper understanding of how to do that. I mean, he's just quoting Paul there, or the author of Thessalonians. Which, and just for the, I did look it up because I read it and was like, whoa, this is the passage he quotes from. Now we command you, beloved, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, to keep away from believers who are living in idleness and not according to the tradition that they have received from us. In fact, most scholars think that because he talks about tradition, it implies that it's a later generation from Paul, which is why a lot of scholars aren't convinced that 2 Thessalonians is written by Paul. For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us. We were not idle when we were with you, and we did not eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with toil and labor we worked night and day, so that we might not burden any of you. This was not because we do not have that right, but in order to give you an example to imitate. For even when we were with you, we gave you this command. Anyone unwilling to work should not eat. For we hear that some of you are living in idleness, mere busybodies, not doing any work. With such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to do their work quietly and to earn their own living. Brothers and sisters, do not be weary in doing what is good.
Sounds like it's addressing a significant, a specific problem in a specific place.
Sure. Certainly read it within its historical context. Mm-hmm. Michael?
Yeah, well, that's the point I wanted to make. I mean, the historical Second Thessalonians is written again in a context where some within the Christian community are talking about the return of Jesus, and again, if contemporary note, someone in this community was named Harold Camping and is saying, you know, the world's going to end May 21st, and after all, if the world is going to end May 21st and Jesus is coming, why should I get a job? Why should I work? I mean, you know, 2 months and it's over. And Paul, or the writer of that, is saying, no, you're all mixed up here.
Sure.
So it's a very different context, or that whole end of the world context. So it's a very different twist on just that little snippet that North is quoting.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think that these people really believe this stuff, or is it just a pretext for they're not wanting to care for people who are different than me? you know, people who are either economically different, racially different, people who have needs that we can help out. Is it just a pretext for that? Or do they really believe this stuff?
I'd open that question to everyone here again. I think that's a real tough question in some ways, because we don't know necessarily what any responses to that kind of question.
I'm sure it's a mixed bag. Some of them do and some of them don't. Some of them might take that 50% they don't give to the government and give it to a church or to, you know, some other charity. And some others probably just keep the money and run.
I've always been fascinated, you know, by the dynamic between those who sort of follow along with the thinking and those who are doing the writing themselves, you know, doing the thinking. It seems like a really uneasy marriage between you know, a certain brand of Christian conservatism and economic conservatism, and I'll be interested to read more of your, to see how he marries those more explicitly. But often it just seems those two things kind of are assumed to go together without very much tying it up.
And let me also, maybe we could push each other. I'm sure those of you who work in a church or any kind of institution, I mean, or have lived at Holden for any extent of time, you know the people who aren't pulling their weight. And we do, you know, there is this, as part of institutions, as part of social cooperation, you know, there are certain expectations that we place on each other for behavior. And, you know, is this kind of huge? Is that kind of attitude that I think most of us have? I mean, you get frustrated with someone, you know, you said you would do this, why aren't you doing it? That's kind of your job. Is it, you know, kind of times 10 here? Or is it, you know, something even more sinister, that ultimately sin is so pervasive in the world that, you know, if you are redeemed, then, you know, you could see some Calvinist influences here. You know, think about Max Weber and the Protestant work ethic. Beyond here, ultimately, that, you know, if God made this world, that, well, God didn't make the world, but, wait, God made the world, but the world through sin and alienation has become about economic scarcity, then guess what? Those who are able to achieve a lot are those who are redeemed. And there's some theological implications here that harken back to the Protestant tradition in particular.
Well, I'm assuming a lot of these people would be anti minimum wage and anti some other benefits, and I would read that second thing, if any would not work, neither should he eat, and I would flip it and say, but if he would work, then he should be able to eat, sleep, provide for family, provide for health, live, and. But if you're opposed to any sort of minimal standard of what a person should earn, it seems inconsistent with
me. Well, I was just going to say, is it necessarily true that this results in economic scarcity, in that there's not enough to go around, or is it really? And if you take that as your thesis, and then you're going to have to, everybody's going to have to work, or we're not going to make it, or they're not going to make it, or is it more a matter of an economic system that, more on the distribution side, I see that, you know, the going straight through to this Christian economics that, you know, that we're going to have laissez-faire, and everything is just going to. Flow out of that, they ignore so many of the variables and costs that would be in there, such as take something simple like the environment. If it's just, if all I'm concerned about is no holds barred, I just need to take care of myself. There's nothing that causes me to worry about the environment or causes me to worry about how others are treated, or something like that, because there's no cost to me because of that. That's not my problem.
Sure.
And then it becomes nobody's problem, and then it's everybody's
sure.
problem.
Sure.
This guy doesn't seem to take into account the cheating and the stealing that has gone on to put the haves where they are. You know, he doesn't seem to take any account of the 400 years of slavery, or the taking the land from the natives, or the, you know, encampments of Asians, you know, all the stuff that was done to make sure that, you know, that whites got ahead, quite frankly. He's not taking that into consideration at all.
I feel like if I tried to defend him, which I'm not really, but I think his answer to a lot of our comments is that in this kind of a world where we are so free from any coercion, we aren't free to act only in our own self-interest, but we are free to love. And if you have to provide health care for all, but it's not a choice of yours, is that actually love, or is that just a thing that you have to do? Of course, assuming that when people are free to love, that they would, that's a very high idea of who we are, unlike what, you know, what our history has shown at times, and that doesn't really go very well with this stuff, you know, his. So that's kind of the same mix of at times we're very low and have a lot of sin, and then at other times we're more free to be good.
I think there's an assumption too that the economic system is inherently neutral, and I think this is a little bit connected to what you said. I think that we financially reward some work so much, so out of proportion to the way that we reward other work, that it gets all. I don't think that the economic system is neutral. And if it, you know, if we flash back to yesterday, some of that conversation about how we can have our utopian ideals, but the reality is that any system we put together is going to be deeply defective. And our challenge, I think, economically, is to at least acknowledge that together so that we can try to counterbalance those defects and move towards a place that that more clearly reflects the fact that each of us are a result of God's imagination and deserves something that resembles a life of abundance.
Well said.
I work in development now, and one of the things that is interesting to me, it's relatively new to me, is the idea of how do we teach people to be patrons from a Christian point of view, as opposed to buying power. What does it mean to be, if I happen to be one of those people who has been highly rewarded financially, what does it mean to take on the responsibility of being a patron in this particular economic system where some are so well rewarded and others are not? I think that's a really interesting question for the church to invite us into, especially those of us who can afford to come to Hilton Village.
Can you go back to Ludwig von Mises? And I have a question for people here. Will you raise your hand if you feel personally that you have a cogent argument against those ideas there?
Oh, sure.
No, I just.
This guy's on the fringe. I mean, he's not even close to mainstream.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in some ways he's more influential than some of the mainstream economists.
common is in terms of both our political discourse, but also sort of the direction that this country is sort of taking.
Isn't this the reason we're in our depression? Because of the laissez-faire free markets, unhampered, unregulated free markets that created a giant bubble that burst?
I've read something, a critique that says the problem with the bubble was the fact that there was regulation.
There was regulation.
If there hadn't been regulation, the bubble wouldn't have happened. That's the assumption.
I thought it was the opposite, but I well, just might be reading a little bit.
Depends on which side you're reading.
I have a couple of quick comments. I don't want to sound like an outsider trying to give a perspective, but Canadian perspective. I once heard somebody saying about, it was actually the president of a seminary saying that people here don't value, this person was American, that people here in Canada don't value education and they're not willing to pay for it. And somebody else at the table said, we do value it, but what we believe in paying for it collectively rather than individually. So the idea that we can collectively decide that something is important and decide to pay for it, it means that we can as a collective say we have values. So the idea that only an individual can have values in is a problem, I guess I see. And I think ultimately, back on your other slide there, you said socialism is turning oneself into God. Maybe I don't know where he's getting that. I'm presuming he's thinking that, you know, socialism thinks that God is the opiate of the masses or something and just sees it as God is extraneous. But I think what he's doing is saying that the individual is God. And the individual, it's really ultimately idolatry. Because there's no limits on the individual, refusing to live in any kind of sense of limits. And including that we should have taxes or laws that would govern us and that we see that as a good, and that we need to have those limits so that we don't just run roughshod over each other.
Yeah, I mean, one question I have for all of you is, and I'm sure there's lots, but what are some theological arguments against this perspective?
Would you repeat that?
What are some theological arguments against this perspective? I mean, in some ways, you know, you brought up Ludwig a lot, but he's trying to defend this based on Christian teaching, sacred scripture, and I think the problem partially comes in how we talk about this, and not just here, but just, you know, it becomes a theological matter. Yeah, for a moment.
I think a theological argument is that all are worthy. America seems to have some obsession with finding people not worthy. And those people tend to be black people and brown people. You know, and I don't get our obsession with who's worthy and who's not worthy. That seems to permeate everything, you know. And the government really is protecting us from these kinds of people. I mean, if it wasn't for the government, with all its flaws, I understand that, you know, probably more of us would be swallowed up in this depression thing than are now. You know, but aside from that.
Of course, his response might be, though, that, okay, you're worthy, but really it's up to you to make or translate that worth into food and shelter and success.
Yeah, well, then we'd have to, in order to do that, we'd have to get rid of people like him. really is an obstacle. I mean, this way of thinking, you know, really is an obstacle, I think.
But again, not wanting to sound like I'm with this guy, but you could make the argument that government practices like redlining would be an argument against government regulation and reach, that institutionalized racism.
Was that a government? Was that government?
Absolutely.
Was that,
absolutely.
That financial system.
That was absolutely, well, it was the two of that with each other, but it was laws. It was government action, sanction.
Well, the government racism. Can be bought.
Right. But I mean, so if the government has no teeth, then can't be bought. I mean, again, not saying that I buy this, but you can make the argument that a very weak government wouldn't have had the power to legislate where people couldn't buy houses and institutionalize racism to promote white privilege for, you know, the better part of a couple of years. And again, not saying that I buy this, but you could make the argument that if the government were weak, individual people would have more strength, and institutional racism would be weakened, and the institution would be weakened.
I think to go back to your question, you know, this is a theology of scarcity, and I think that we would say, hopefully, that which is most important, being love and grace, is abundant, and returns more than you invest in it, right? And so that which is ultimately significant isn't scarce at all, and that should be the basis of our theological and political and ethical thinking, more so than the idea that our resources are ultimately quite restricted.
Awesome.
Well, and even in the realm of food, these days we have plenty of food. You know, it's not, there are distribution issues, you know, but even as a whole, as a planet, we produce enough food for everyone to eat. And so it's not like there's a threat of like, oh, you've got to work or our little tribe is all going to die. It's just, you know, at this point, you can't rely on that. He needs to rely on just the moral argument of only those people should be able. And that it loses some of its force.
Well, if his scriptural basis is fallacious in the interpretation, then the whole thing collapses.
Another argument here is you know, God has cursed the earth. Okay, so why has God cursed the earth? The bottom line then does not follow. God cursed the earth because, one, the individual is not a responsible being. That's why he's cursed to begin with. Right? We were created responsible, and Genesis 3 showed we're not responsible. And if he holds to a basic notion of sin, which obviously he does, God cursed the earth, well, so much for responsible being. So, you know, his system could work if you could find a responsible being, but since you can't, good luck.
Well, and hasn't Christ redeemed us? And doesn't that change things a little bit?
I was thinking that's the theological counter-argument, mm-hmm. is that the covenant sort of, mm-hmm. it's not so much about cursing the earth, and it's not about you bad human. That's what it's all about, right? Mm-hmm. So theologically, again, if you take that God isn't mad at us anymore, that sort of pulls the rug.
Yeah, it's certainly not very thick theology.
I'm sort of perplexed. I feel like God has cursed the earth with people like this. I really am just totally perplexed with why we have to deal with people like this. I'm by like this, I mean him, Bachman, you know, all those people, we all know who they are. They just seem to be in the way of any kind of justice or fairness, and it bothers me. I mean, that's my bigger issue, is that people like that.
What is it about them that appeals to people?
Yeah. Why will people go against their own interests for these people? It just bothers me. It seems satanic.
And that's the $10,000 question.
Well, I think the answer, the part in the capitalist system, these people have all the right in the world to make a lot of money doing this stuff. And they are.
But in their connection with the evangelical movement, which I'm pretty familiar with, coming from where I do, the economics of this is negative to the interests of most evangelicals, but these social issues reach them so much that they don't understand the economic issues.
Or that they don't vote.
They don't vote on economics, they vote on the social issues.
I think if you take each one of those points, compare them with the Sermon on the Mount, and the Sermon on the Mount trumps each one individually. Okay? That's the way I feel. I think the whole approach is, and I agree with Earl, it's negative, it's not positive, it's not looking to the future for to solve problems, it's complaining.
It's the law.
That's my feeling.
Yeah, it's insane. Another thing is, as man fell, a gracious gift from God was the law, and continues, you know, it brings order to the world. So if you look at, new law comes in that, you know, you can overdo it, obviously, but you need something to order the society. You just can't have the individual all working as their own master.
Well, I certainly do think it's telling that the sort of proof text that he does, you don't mention Christ at all. Even though the title of the book is Christian.
And not dealing with the intensely communal nature of Israel's religion as well. I mean, that was based on community responsibility in huge ways.
It's five, so I don't want to keep anyone beyond the time.
Just a quick facetious question. Is this guy a hermit?
You can go to his website and he'll give you wealth building techniques.
Wow. He'll give us or he'll sell us.
Well, you'll have to sell.
I can give you the wealth.
I guess so.
The Austrian classical, and I would really get this one and brought this to like 300 years ago or something.
It was like something that was the first that he said.
I have to admit, I'm here for a while. We have to read this.
I was thinking, I thought it was a bunch of your grandfather. I think he does.
But you have to just wade through this.
It's interesting. I've been sitting and.
I mean, that's
well,
exactly
it,
like
you know,
for
it,
law,
it,
you
it,
should just...
Yeah, we talked talk about this, I think,
and the
industry
is your thing on marketing of water was perfect.
And we ended up talking
about... Because Michelle Hockey markets herself the same way that Aquafina markets itself.
Part of the problem with the evangelical
movement
is that it's a Bible center.
Whoever it is.
Not sophisticated.
Create a false fear that there's a problem that doesn't actually exist.
And so this kind of theology appeals to that kind of
version
frame
of
reference.
Yourself as the solution to that problem.
I think that's another issue.
So it,
And I think sometimes, right, again, you know, mainline Christians and whatnot are just, you know, far too nice in terms of certain folks like North and Company. You know, even you can't even classify them as evangelical. I mean, all they are is they're simply using this kind of cherry picking of Christianity to legitimate corporate capitalism.
Sure.
I mean, that's all. There's nothing.
But then, of course, they would say they respond to that.
This is just corporate capitalism.
You're an intellectual, and you come from a different tradition that espouses and.
Well, are you going to deny that God has given us reason and that we can think through such that we can know bullshit when we see it?
I'm not making that argument. Sarah Palin, the lamestream meter, I mean, it's a critique of the loons and their education, and that place of the mass is
a bit away.
You know,
even though I know there's a poll or something, but it goes through Pew that basically said that like 70% of American Christians consider capitalism and Christianity incompatible. So,
well, I think,
I mean, you know, why does capitalism work? I mean, Keynes in his classic book on it just simply said, well, it's greed.
You made little stabs at it.
As people are greedy, capitalism is going to work. As long as people are greedy, North gets an audience.
You know, maybe this kind
of
thing. Can I just run by the beginning or the opening of Vespers?
Has it changed?
I don't know whether it's changed or it's morphed.
Okay.
I'm still thinking of doing the same thing with spacing the kids and handbells around. And it's just going to be a very random,
back to this
any pitch kind of ring.
Who's worthy and who's not?
But I'm thinking of using that to get into an opening hymn of.
I think there's some elements of it.
Oh, for a thousand times to sing.
Okay. I'm just thinking about timing.
Right.
My part to about 16 minutes.
Okay. I'm thinking that. All of that might be 4 minutes, because the random ring obviously can't go on itself forever. And I'm just thinking of it as once people get used to the sound and the noise, I'd like to just, all right, let's get into the action. So I think after Stephen Chuck or whoever does the intros, and then Scott will say something, and Scott will go up to the congregation or the village by saying, make sure there's a hymn book open to 886 or something like that, and so we'll go from there.
Is there for the day?
I think it is.
I'm doing the hymn book with
86. Which one is that?
It's Finlandia, I think. This is my song.
Oh, all right, okay. Yeah, and I think Oh for a Thousand Tongues is
86.
So,
it's just much easier to identify the other when you perform to it, or the physical market. See, that guy, he's the other. He's not one of us. So, I want you to be afraid of him, so that you will, sort of seek for your mind, the tiger kind of thing. Pay attention to that guy over here while I stick it to you over here.
I just sat down for another totally different thing. I just wanted to know if anybody had talked to you yet about tonight's forum.
No.
Okay. Because while you were out on the hike, someone during the coffee hour suggested, wouldn't it be fun if we had a hold of Hilaric?
I don't know any OEM
leaders. Yeah, Michael suggested it.
Whoa!
He suggested, like, in the old days, sometimes they would have a but not Ole's family. So we're just looking for Holden Joe stories.
The topic, Holden hilarity, in the sense of. What are some of the hilarious things that
happy to you while it holds the permanent awareness into it. So, and just open it up to everybody.
Open mic. I'm hoping there are no fans.
At all.
Because I hate them as much as
I do. I don't know. I just never, when I first moved here, I didn't understand.
I didn't participate in that culture either, so, you know, I'm German background,
yeah,
so
I never thought they were funny. I figured this is for you to say why.
Because Germans didn't have jokes, did they?
No, they don't.
They were
more
of
a
sense of humor.
Yeah. I never laughed growing up in my family. That's
it was sinful.
Except maybe farting. We had farting. But that was a normal.
Canadians, on the other hand, are incredibly funny.
Not all of us, but.
There's
that self-deprecating humor, actually, that I think Canadians do well. Because we live next to the U.S. that is always the mighty, and we're, you know, the underdog, so it's easier to imagine ourselves in that role.
But when you laugh at yourself, it's just really.
Well, we love to do that actually a lot. So, like on this hour's 22 minutes, you know, there's a talking to Americans section where we just like to show how stupid Americans are. That they know nothing about Canada.
It's not hard to do.
Which is pretty true. Yeah, I mean, vote. So, but anyway, I just wanted to tell you. So, if you did have anything you wanted to contribute tonight. I'm sure, or if you want to bring some of your pages of jokes, that if it gets dry and there's not, because there hasn't been a lot of time for people to prepare, so maybe people can just even read jokes. I don't know. I don't know if you have anything to contribute, but I hope you do, because I think it might flop tonight.
Or you know, just tell a few funny Holden stories.
Yeah.
I was thinking.
He told some pretty funny stories.
I heard that it was not necessarily family friendly.
That's true.
Speaking of family, I didn't mean.
Yeah, we gotta get some food on your menu, Tyler.
Yeah.
This is a priority meal.
Meat, is it?
Really?
Yeah, proper, said the lady.
Proper?
Is that your book?
No, it was already there. I don't know what.
Anybody else's? Okay. Probably grass.
Might be chicken.
Anything.
Something that used to be attached to a bone.